Okay, so we have a very, very special podcast today. I'm actually super excited. I actually don't know how many people are aware that when we're doing podcasts, usually we're not in the same time zone, and we're talking like via the magic of Skype and such. But today I've actually got Narni Webbers with me in the room right now. I just touched Patter Twig's pal's mic because I can. So we have a few Narni Webbers with us today, and with me today, I should say. With us today. This is so different from looking at a webcam. Because recently went to see a play, a theatrical production of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which we'll hear a little more about today, and we're going to do a little review podcast of it. I don't know how little it will be, actually. This could go on indefinitely, in actual fact. Basically, overall thoughts on this play seem to be overall positive based on the opinions of the three moderators here. With some intriguing negatives as well. So a little teaser there. But first, before we get into the juicy stuff, let's go around the table here. On my left, we have...
Patter Twig's pal. I've been on the forum for about 7 years. I'm the moderator of cast and character discussions and the reading group.
Cool. And then directly in front of me, we have...
I'm Melton Talley. I am the moderator of costumes and Narnia merchandise. And I have been on the forum since 2005.
Cool. And then on my right, we have...
I'm Raidian. I'm a Dittotown moderator. And I've been on the forum I just had my 12-year anniversary last month.
Woo! All right, so let's get a little context here, because people are listening to this and they're like, okay, play of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, what are we talking about here? And there's been quite a few theatrical productions of, is that the right term, by the way? Not theatrical. It'd be, what would I call it? Stage production of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? A play. It's a play of The Lion, stage version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So let's get a little context. Let's start with you, Raya, as I'll refer to you as. So where are we and what are we?
So we went to see a play. The play was in Stratford, Ontario, which it's a town that seems to have a very large theater influence. They actually had a museum there that also had a Narnia exhibit, which we saw that too. But as for the play, we went to see it in a theater that seated probably about 200, and I think it was nearly a full house, something
okay.
like that.
So I would normally say, you know, it's only fair, this is what I say with a movie adaptation at least, so it's only fair to judge it as a movie first, or in this case, it's only fair to judge it as a play first. Let's throw all that out the window. And I want to know right now, because I did not go see the play, in case that's not clear, so I have a lot of questions for these guys. They've already told me a little bit. So I guess I'll ask you, Twigs. So, like, how is it close to the book, kind of the simple yes or no, and then, well, how close? Is it more like the Walden movie, or is it more like BBC, where it's more or less word for word? So how would you kind of, how close to the book are they?
I would say it's pretty close to the book. There were some glaring changes, but there were several lines also that came straight from the books, and I could quote them as it was going along. They took time to do scenes... well, that could be skipped over or very shortened in the Walden version. So I'd say in that respect, it's more like the BBC.
Okay. So you say it's not, so you would say it's not, it's definitely, in terms of, we could debate what faithful to the book really means and all that. Not now. but in terms of literal, you know, dialogue and plot points, you would say it's somewhere between like the Walden version and BBC then?
Yes.
Okay. But of course, there's music in it, though.
There is music in it.
Yes. So that is, I guess, a change from the book, I would say. Probably some concerns right away. Or what about on a technical level? How do they do the sets? How do they handle Aslan and the talking animals and all that? And how do they make all that kind of come to life?
So most of the animals were single actors in a costume. So the beavers were full body suits. The centaurs were half person, and then they had a mannequin end that was on, I think, wheels that would roll around.
So they could move around.
They definitely moved around. And then they had puppets for some of the smaller creatures. And Aslan was a very large puppet, mm-hmm. With articulated legs and a swishing tail and very lifelike face.
I was really impressed by the Aslan puppet. When he'd walk, they didn't just have the leg kind of move forward. The leg would actually like bend at the joints, so it looked like he was actually moving his legs to walk, mm-hmm. to a certain degree. And the puppet was really impressively big too. It was manned by two people, and like Aslan stood about as tall as the witch did, which was, it was really nice to just, it was a very, it was a, you know, huge puppet, and it had the scale that an Aslan puppet really needed.
That's really cool, because I always felt that Aslan in the movies is too small, but then again, it would be weird to have a ginormous lion that could, like, swallow you whole. But I guess in the play, you could certainly get away with that a little more.
I will say that at first, the puppet confused me, because he looked too skinny and he was kind of weird colors and stuff. And then I figured out he was really made of pages from a book. And if you go out on their website and you look at the close-ups, most of the pages that created Aslan say The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe on them. And I think...
Aslan's out trying to market the play. Well, he's an artist.
That was
interesting
kind of,
detail.
Yeah, and it was kind of a common theme because some of the set pieces were stacks of books that they would reshape into. I think they use that for like the Four Thrones and just for set pieces.
Interesting. Okay. I don't remember exactly, but didn't you twig something about there being quotes from the book they would use throughout, like on the screen? Because they had rear projection screens as the background they would typically use.
If they were, they would project a picture of what the scenery is supposed to be, and then kind of as an overlay, as a background to that, there would be lines from the book that would kind of fade in and out based on whether they were going where the scenery, the like mountains or whatever, but it showed you where you were at in the book.
Can you think of any examples as far as
of course
any
not.
Quotes that were used? Anyone remember any ones that were?
I was actually, it was kind of those ones where it's kind of like it's sliding across the screen and there's more than one, so I wasn't able to read them.
So it's more of ambience than actually being able to.
Very much.
Yeah. You couldn't read the whole lines. You could read enough to
it's
know.
Like decoration, basically. Yeah. So between that and like the pages that kind of decorate Aslan, it seems like literature, storytelling is kind of a theme.
Visually, they had a really strong book theme. It wasn't brought up so much in the actual dialogue, but visually there's a huge book theme.
Uh-huh. So what are some things that they had in here that you were happy to see, especially things that maybe don't make it in, that generally don't make it into adaptations?
When Aslan was restoring the statues and then mustering the troops that he had just freed, he did his line where he talked about that people needed to come forward with him, with us lions, and then the lion came forward and said how happy he was that Aslan used us lions. That has not been in any other adaptation that I personally have seen or listened to.
The character hasn't even really spoken, has it? Like maybe in the Focus on the Family.
No.
Not even that.
Not even on the Focus on the Family.
Wow. And not even in BBC.
And I think that was probably one of the scenes that pleased most of the Narnia Webbers, if not all of us. We were thrilled to see the us lions lion get in there.
And as I recall, when the children first enter the wardrobe room, Edmund comments on a dead beetle on the windowsill.
Okay, so they mentioned it at least.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's just a throwaway line, but I do remember that being in there.
Father Christmas is in this version, and he's been cut out of some versions.
To show Father Christmas coming, they had this little sleigh on a couple of sticks that they were
a very light up Christmas decoration type sleigh, which was really unnecessary because Father Christmas himself was really well done. He was more a European style Father Christmas figure. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that look in kind of the concept art for Narnia. He was in green, whereas in the Walden movie, he's in red.
Okay. So there is a good bit of humor throughout the production. Is that fair to say? And there's been some discussion about, and maybe I'll ask you, Mel, about there was definitely some discussion in the reactions I've read from the moderators that attended about the humor. And why don't you talk about some of that?
Well, there were some ad-lib lines that, you know, reference current events or popular musicals. Mr. Tumnus makes a Be My Guest joke.
Mm-hmm. And goes on to sing part of the song.
Oh, yeah. Does he actually? Okay.
And he apologizes for his French accent, which seemed like it was a little bit over the top. And I believe the other thing that really caught some flack among our group was Lucy comments on Mr. Tumnus's bookshelf. And instead of reading off the titles from the book, She comments on he has 50 shades of fur, which seemed a little bit out of place.
I think it was Shasta's twin was talking about a moment with Professor Kirk, Kirk in general felt too goofy as a character.
Oh, yes. Yes. Way too goofy.
And they were also a little too unsubtle about the idea that he's probably been to Narnia before.
Interesting.
And the one thing that I thought that the Walden version, and I know this has been discussed before, but with the Walden version, that he more or less doesn't really believe Lucy until the possibility comes up that she went through the wardrobe and that's how she got to Narnia, and then he starts taking the idea seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that there was kind of a similar feeling in this play where the professor was pretty explicit about. He, basically has a sentence where he stops just short of saying he went to Narnia.
Okay. Now, so there's a clear Magician's Nephew reference at some point, right?
Yes, there is. When the professor is actually giving the children a tour of the house, and he stops at a picture of two children on a winged horse.
Ah.
And he starts telling them about it, and then they're interrupted somehow or something.
So they had fun with it, the sort of Magician's Nephew thing.
Yes, they had fun with it.
Okay. As we were kind of warming up, I was saying, so this is a musical, right? And some of you nodded and some of you shook your heads. So is this a musical? There's music in it.
there are definitely songs in it. But shortly after the break, they got to come to the table, which is one that I think was pretty universally liked in our group.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically a song that the Narnians sang as they all approached the table. And then it ended with Aslan coming in and making his glorious entrance. And the song itself felt like a Narnian hymn. It was cool. Really good. Mr. Tumnus had a song that he sang for Lucy. It was about the same point in the book where he's playing the flute for her.
Did it make you want to laugh and cry and go to sleep all at the same time?
That part. And awesome. And he sings the song. It's kind of a, and it was kind of like a ballad about what Narnia had been like before the winter. And then it kind of gets a little more somber at the end. The song is called Always Winter Now, and it's kind of like, well, this is what Narnia used to be like, but it's always winter now.
Okay.
So that was the first song.
Longing, I like that.
Yeah, and then felt like those songs could have been sung in-universe.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, in a lot of that's another reason why it's like, is it a musical? Because these songs, you could almost imagine the Narnians actually singing it in the story.
Okay.
But because it's kind of, because the Come to the Table song was like almost like an invitation to everybody to.
In film terms, diegetic music, essentially.
Yes. Okay. During the Stone Table sacrifice scene, they had kind of a dark reprise of Come to the Table where the witches' forces were singing it. And it was like Come to the Carnival. And it was like, it was very similar to the Come to the Table song, but the words were completely different. And I think the tune was also adjusted.
Probably taken down into a minor key.
Yeah, it was definitely a darker song.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm hearing you talk about the music, and it's for the most part positive comments, it sounds like. But still, I know there's some people listening, maybe myself included, I'm kind of like, Narnia is a musical? Not that it can't work, but I get a little bit nervous. So it kind of, me personally, I immediately start wondering, is this a comedy, basically? Is this really lighthearted and silly? Mel, let me just ask you, how do you feel tonally the music affects the story? Like, is this just a comedy? And how do they handle darker moments like Aslan's death?
Well, as Raya said, they did a dark reprise for Aslan's death, which I thought really added to the atmosphere of the scene. So in that part, it's not a comedy. The first half of the play in general was a lot more lighthearted and maybe even with the professor's antics a little bit silly, but it was still very faithful to the book in that way.
So you don't feel they went too, it's too light and silly?
It's not too light and silly, and I think they did a good job of pairing the music style with the story. So it's not an overwhelming symphonic sort of thing. And it was very Celtic. There were I think Penny Whistle at some point, and probably violin, and maybe a guitar as well. So it was not, it was very small scale, but it worked.
Mm-hmm. Good. So it sounds like we don't feel the music, like the music felt, it didn't feel too out of place for the most part, you would agree? It felt organic to the story, and it didn't offend you as a fan of the book or anything.
Well.
And Twig speaks up.
Yes. Some of it was really, really good, really fitting. The White Witch's song, taunt, rap, whatever you want to call it, really didn't seem to fit, especially since they had the White Witch referencing Aslan's prophecy and then writing her own prophecy about how it wouldn't come true while Edmund was sitting on the sledge eating the Turkish delight.
Which seemed like he was like, super oblivious at that point. Yes, it's like, but it's just,
so that kind of sounds like, what do they call it in a play where it's like the characters on stage can't hear it, but the audience can.
Like kind of,
sorry, what's it called? A soliloquy. Someone want to say that?
A soliloquy.
I could see it in my head.
How is Edmund not hearing this or registering this?
Too focused on the Turkish delight, perhaps.
Probably. But that's one that I would say felt more along the lines of a musical, a comedic thing. It was very nah, you can't get me, or like type teasing thing.
Well, I didn't object to the song so much as I objected to where it was. If they had moved it to after Edmund goes to her castle and he says, please, can I have some more Turkish delight? If at that point she had revealed her plan, that would have felt more revealing her true nature as opposed to getting it in really early, which tells the audience that, oh, she's not actually a nice person.
So you're saying in this version, we know right away. Yeah. Whereas the Walden version, I think, although if you're an adult, you're probably like, oh, yeah, she's obviously evil, but they try to be kind of subtle about it, and it is a bit of a reveal. Then how dare you come alone is a bit of a reveal. But you're saying here they straight up tell you
they straight up tell you that she has, she has not got good intentions towards the kids.
And the Turkish delight is enchanted, right? In this version of the story, it's not in the Walden version, or at least it's not mentioned, nor in the focus on the family radio drama. It's not mentioned. It's enchanted.
I'm pretty sure the intent is that in story, it magically appeared for Edmund. And the beaver does reference, you can see it in his eyes. He's eaten her food. So I don't know if they ever use the word enchantment directly, but
it was implied.
It's hard to work that into the dialogue because in the book it's in the narration, and it's a little harder to work that into the dialogue without it sounding like, oh yes, eat my enchanted Turkish delight. That doesn't sound suspicious.
I'm intrigued by someone mentioned a counter spell the White Witch says that's sort of similar to the prophecy but different.
Yeah, talks about having the four thrones empty and it will be always winter. So basically, it's like an inversion of the, it was spring will come, Aslan will shake his mane.
So she has her own little rhyme.
She has her own little version of that.
Okay.
And that part of it, I thought, kind of worked because if you think about it, the White Witch lives in a world where she knows about the deep magic and she knows their kind of rules. And there's a prophecy that basically says she's going to die. So in order to function, she's kind of got to have an anti-prophecy. Otherwise, she's always got that lingering over her that no matter what she does, Aslan is going to come back and he's going to defeat her. So for me, it worked. I know it's an addition to the book, but it worked for me. And then when the witch and... Oh, that's something to note. Her minion was not a dwarf. It was a troll.
Really?
Yeah, they called it a troll every time.
It was less human, basically. That's interesting. In the play, you'd think they'd want to trend towards being human. But
he didn't. He still looked pretty humanoid. Uh-huh. It's just they never. I mean, I think he might have had a beard. Did he have a beard?
Yeah, he had one of the evil villain beards.
Pointy beards, yeah. They only referred to him as the troll.
Okay.
In fact, I don't think they ever used the word dwarf in the entire play.
Okay.
In Edmund's rescue, when the rescue party comes charging onto the stage, they kind of obscure the witch and the troll for just a little bit. And when they move apart, you see a boulder and a stump. And for a moment,
you just... Oh, so they do the stump and the boulder.
They do the stump and
That's never in adaptations.
And they do it on stage where you're like, okay, how did they do that? How did they get a prop in there and the actor off the stage in, 5 seconds without you noticing something out of the corner of your eye?
Okay, so I'm glad they included the witch and the dwarf disguising themselves as a stump and the boulder, which always gets cut out of adaptations. What are kind of the big standout moments for you guys as a play? A few of you mentioned before we started the stone table cracking.
Well, one thing with the stone table, they actually had kind of a platform in the middle of the stage that would raise it. That's where the lamppost came from. It was kind of like a disc that would raise up as a platform. And there was part of, within that, there was a lamppost that could rise all the way up.
Uh-huh. And the lamppost like rises out of the ground. Yes. Like it grows kind of like Magician's Nephew, you said, right?
So. Yes. Oh, it is missing the crossbar, but I personally can forgive them for that because it kind of had to come out of the floor. But the stone table cracking, and I remember watching and kind of going, how are they going to do that? That's the same platform they've been using the whole play, and you can't exactly destroy a prop mid-play.
Uh-huh. Yep, I had the same thought.
Yeah, and then what they did was they had lighting on the table, which lit up like it cracked.
Oh, neat.
And yeah. They had a really loud thundering boom, and it was actually really impressive.
Okay. Cool. How about the actual first time we see Narnia? How do they? It's a play after all. How do they transition from being in the spare room to being into Narnia? How effectively is that done?
So let's see. Lucy walks into the wardrobe, and then do they flip it around so that she comes out the back?
I kind of remember that being.
Yeah, and then you can kind of see her pushing through the coats, and then they're moving trees on the stage.
Right, and the trees were actual. No, the trees weren't people. Were they?
No,
there were people behind the trees.
Okay. I mean, like, in the universe, they weren't supposed to be trees. I was trying to remember if there were people wearing tree costumes or not.
No, they were actually. No, they were just tree props.
Right. How about the cast? What are our overall thoughts on? So I think the, okay, and I'm seeing some smirks of, I'm not quite sure how to read these. I'm interested. I understand that the kids are a lot old, well, not surprisingly, a lot older than what their characters are.
Yes, the kids were played by adults. The one who did Susan was amazing. She was very much Susan. No objections whatsoever there. Edmund did a really good job most of the time. But with Lucy, I think the actress was trying a little bit too hard to sound young. It was a very high-pitched nasal voice. And from the beginning, it grated on me. I mean, it could just be me. But
I felt the same way.
But
hard to top Georgie, I guess. But it sounds like overall we like the cast. Pretty. What was our favorite performance?
I liked the voice they had for Aslan. I don't know if I want to go so far to say it was my favorite, but I actually really liked the voice they had for Aslan.
And that was the same actor who was playing the professor, right? So
yes, it was. Uh-huh. And Aslan was a lot. The portrayal of Aslan was much truer to the book. Than the portrayal of the professor. The professor was much too silly. Uh-huh. Well, for example, when Peter and Susan come to talk to him, he's playing with a model ship and some cars or something, and just very childish.
Is that like? Do they have like the? Does he outline the three possibilities? They race through that scene in the Walden version.
Yeah, I think he still did the three. He still did, but leading up to that, he's wandering around. Playing with his toys, not really paying a whole lot of attention to them. Uh-huh.
Right, but do they get into like his logical argument they have in the book? And
I remember I'm pretty sure it happened.
I'm pretty sure he did. He went through the three options and everything once he finished with his toys.
The three possibilities that Lucy's either telling the truth, or she's lying, or she's crazy.
He did still kind of rush through it, but he didn't like skip the dialogue. It's just more he just went through it very quickly.
Okay. Going back to the cast, when I mentioned the White Witch before we started recording, there were some more like knowing glances at each other.
I thought her performance was really good. She had a very commanding presence. She was very forceful. She made you believe that she was the White Witch.
One thing is that she was occasionally over the top, but I feel like most of the characters at one point in the play or another, except Aslan. Pretty much every character had a point where it was just like, you're going really over the top.
A play tends to do that a little bit, I think, because it's not like a movie where you can have close-ups of people, you know. You kind of have to project yourself, you know, to kind of get the emotion across. But Twigs, on my left over here, has, if those of you that don't know, is a lifelong, what about lifelong, a supporter of the BBC productions of Narnia. But pretty much lifelong, probably, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. Well, and including Barbara Kellerman's performance, which is somewhat polarizing among fans. And so with on the scale of over-the-topness, with Tilda Swinton on one side and Barbara Kellerman on the other, where does this actress rank?
I'd put her kind of somewhere in between with slightly closer to Barbara Kellerman. I thought she still had that... I do like Barbara Kellerman's portrayal of the over-the-top, the evil that's not popular with some people. But I would say she toned that down a little bit, but she still had some of that over-the-top. Definitely not as subtle as Tilda Swinton.
Swinton's much more reserved. And yes. She kind of whispers a little bit more.
So she'd be somewhere in between the two.
Okay. How about the lines about the deep magic, which, you know, in the Walden version, for example, there is no deeper magic. There's just a deep magic. And so...
As I recall, he did refer to the deeper magic. I feel like... And that's one thing that I felt, the point where Aslan died to the point where the girls find him alive again, they did have the scene with the mice chewing off the cords. You couldn't see the mice. The girls basically said, there are mice chewing on it. And because you're so far away from the stage, you can just kind of pretend like you can see it. But they basically pulled it off. They walk away a little bit and then the crack happens, which while that was very impressive, again, it felt like Aslan wasn't really dead long enough, because the book just kind of paces itself differently.
Would you guys agree with that?
Well, I think it was fine for me.
Mostly, I was just impressed with how well that whole sequence went.
Yes.
As a production.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and how they worked it, and you know, with a play, I'm more lenient, more understanding. They only have so much time. They only have so much they can do on a stage that it'd be hard to make it seem long enough.
Oh, and Aslan's roar was very impressive.
Okay, which is sort of a disappointment in the Walden version for me. So Aslan had a cool roar?
He did. And the witch was properly terrified by it. And...
Okay. Yeah. Roars are kind of hard to describe. So could you go ahead and do it for us? I'm kidding. So how do they handle the battle? How do they handle, you know, in the BBC, they really struggled with, maybe Twiggs might even admit they kind of struggled with that. How big does it feel, and how do they manage to convey scale in the play?
Okay, so let's back up to way back in the first act, when the children are going to bed, there is a music box in the middle of the girls' room that goes around and it throws shadows on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the foreshadowing of Narnia.
Right, because the shadows, they're mostly animals, but I think you might be able to see like a centaur.
So they're at the house at this point.
And the girls have a music box in their room, and it's throwing shadows on the wall.
Okay.
And so in the battle, that music box comes back, and it's throwing shadows on the wall. And I don't know if they've actually changed the shadows or not.
I don't remember that specific detail.
They might have. I have a feeling that the shadows did at some point in the play morph and change, and
so they're lighted, the lighting moves around the stage kind of while the shadows are going around,
little spotlight,
yeah, a little spotlight, so a little montage of the battle in what would be little individual scene just moved around.
Okay, so my concern with that when I hear that is, does that, do you feel like it's implied that Narnia is just their imaginary place, or like Wizard of Oz, where it's just a dream she had?
There was a very Wizard of Oz feel to that set up in the first scene, because they have the professor going through the house, and you can see kind of country people around the house, and specifically you see the actors playing the beavers.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Okay, they're similar
to Wizard of Oz, where it's like similar, like, oh, you see the real characters, and then later it's the Scarecrow and the Tin Man.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Andrew Adamson kind of went out of his way to make it clear in his version that, no, this is absolutely real. This isn't just something in their heads or something. This really happened.
Whereas this one took more of the Wizard of Oz movie version.
So that maybe it was just their imagination.
Maybe.
It was kind of hard to say what they were trying to go for with that. There was definite references also that the wardrobe led to Narnia, that the professor had been there.
Uh-huh.
So I was just not sure which they were going for. If they're going for, yes, it is a place, or going for the more Wizard of Oz, the movie version where it was just a dream she had with all these people from her real life.
I mean, there were definitely some blurring the line moments, but they didn't do it like they did in The Wizard of Oz, where like the Scarecrow and the farmhand, who's played by the same actor, straight up have the same mannerisms. Uh-huh. They didn't go that far.
What do you guys think about the way Aslan was just as a character? So I think we're all pretty happy with how he was achieved technically, but as a character, so my personal opinion of Aslan, let's say in the Walden version, is that he just seems a little tame, I guess. And he seems like he's not that all that important to the story. It's really the kids that are the heroes, and Aslan's just kind of this, yes, kids, you have done well. You're doing great. You know, he doesn't seem like he's all that important. And I felt that, you know, Liam Neeson did an okay job, but I feel like I wanted Aslan to feel more powerful and have a bigger role in the story. But just Aslan as a character, how do you guys feel he came across in the play?
Definitely feel that he was very central, very important. When he was first introduced to the children, the idea, the beavers are talking to him, and we saw the trees reacting to his name, like moving around.
Oh,
and
cool. And so it's like the moment in the book when it's, you know, they hear Aslan's name and all the kids feel these different emotions. And in the Walden version, all they kind of do is stare awkwardly at the camera.
The trees moved.
So the trees around them from Aslan's name kind of.
Yes. They reacted to Aslan's name.
Did that feel like a powerful moment?
Yeah. Yes, it did. It was, you could tell the trees were listening and reacting, and that Aslan's name triggered
That's really cool. That's something that adaptations have really struggled to get across. And it is such a book thing where Lewis just tells you this is what all the characters were feeling. But how do you do that when it's not, when you don't have a narrator to tell you that? And so that sounds like a really pretty cool dramatic way to convey that.
Yes. And then when we first saw Aslan, they had, you know, they had the center stage raised up. So there was the table. They had like this tent pavilion background. And they were singing the Come to the Table, and as they were talking about the certain animals that were to come to the table, they'd come through the tent. Then I think probably the last one to come through was Aslan. So he emerged out of this dark tent into the light, climbed up onto the stone table, and was the center point of all the creatures and the people. And I think the Pevensies showed up right about then too. So he was very much front and center in that scene.
And coming out of the darkness like he did, he looked enormous.
Yes.
That sounds like a good big dramatic moment. So Aslan's introduction sounds like really big. Awesome.
They basically had to pause the play for a bit because everyone was clapping.
That's awesome. Okay. Well, I think we're about ready to wrap up, so I'm just going to go around and ask you guys final overall thoughts, and let's start with you, Twigs, and go around the table.
Oh, I liked it a lot. It was overall, it was a really good adaptation. I was satisfied with it.
Okay.
I mean, I'm going to nitpick it, but I was satisfied. Well, it was mostly satisfied.
On NarniWeb.com? Say it isn't so. How about you, Mel? Just overall thoughts. What'd you think of the play?
Overall, I would say I really liked it. I would go again. Probably as many times as I could, which I can't since I'm not in Canada. I would take somebody who hadn't read the book. I would probably drive them crazy saying, but that wasn't the way it is in the book. You need to read the book now. But yeah, overall, I think they did a really, really good job.
Awesome. Raya.
I also enjoyed it for the most part. And again, I think I've made it pretty clear, like the second half better than the first half. But I did enjoy it overall. I enjoyed watching it as a play and as an adaptation of Narnia. As for whether I would bring somebody who had never seen Narnia before, I would maybe like go with somebody and kind of, again, like Mel said, I would explain, you know, this isn't in the book. Read the book. You'll
it's
understand.
It's our job, Narnie Webbers. Educate people. Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I guess as most people listening to this won't actually get to see the play. So I'm glad they have our Narnie Webber nitpicker reactions, which is essential, crucial. So since we're in the middle of a lull right now as far as movie news, it is definitely filling a void to have something to nitpick, something to just tear apart for good or for bad, you know, but definitely it's good that I wish I could go see it because it sounds like, you know, you guys overall liked it and enjoyed it. And it's always usually fun to see a Narnie adaptation. Before I go, Twigs, do you want to give us a shameless plug for the Voyage of the Dawn Treader reading group that's going on in the discussion forum right now, if anybody wants to take part?
Yes, I would love to. There's still time to do the Voyage of the Dawn Treader reading group. You can...
What is the reading group?
For each chapter, a few of the mods come up with a list of questions. You do not have to answer all the questions because it may look a little overwhelming at first, but you can pick and choose. you don't even have to answer the questions. You can just post your thoughts on the chapter. This time we're doing a little bit of a kind of a competition where you can earn awards. Mel actually drew a wonderful map of the book based on each chapter. And for each chapter, you can earn some achievements. You get one just for simply posting something. Mm-hmm. And if you post to for all the questions, you get a different one. There's some awards you can do for getting, if you start a discussion, if somebody quotes you and continues on your thought, then you can get a discussion starter award. And then for people who make it to the end, there's a point system and you can place and get something there too.
Okay.
And it's definitely worth going in there to read the answers to some of the questions.
And to get there, you just go, you know, click on forum, and then it just Voyage to the Dawn Twitter reading group.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So we're going to stop recording shortly, but I'm sure we'll keep talking about all kinds of things afterwards. You know what? I'm just going to stir the pot. How do you guys feel about Silver Chair coming up? What are our Mark Gordon company? We haven't really had any news for a while, but
cautiously optimistic.
Okay.
Mixed emotions, you know, like I definitely want the movie to be made, wondering if where things are and if things are going to happen, because it's been so long.
It's been a while since we had a solid news story. So I think they're just, I still think Silverchair is going to happen, but I don't know when. We may have to wait. Cool. All right. How do we feel about The Green Mist?
Wow. You had to go there.